What's up, QAA listeners?
The fun and games have begun.
I found a way to connect to the internet. I'm sorry, boy.
Welcome, listener, to Premium Chapter 138 of the QAnon Anonymous Podcast, the Aryans in Atlantis episode. As always, we are your hosts, Jake Rogatansky,
Liv Agar,
Julian Field,
and Travis View.
This week, Liv has fallen backwards off a boat in full diving gear to explore the lost city of Atlantis, the homeland of an ancient Aryan race, according to an American pseudo-archaeologist and Civil War-era politician. In the murky depths, Liv will prop up a whiteboard and explain how these ideas came to find a home in spiritual theosophy before making their way to Austria, where anti-Semitic occultists used it to form a secret society that fueled the rise of the Nazi Party. We ask that you not touch the coral, as it is poisonous, and refrain from bothering marine life, as it can become aggressive.
Make Atlantis great again.
Atlantis is a mythology that one may not expect to have influenced Nazi ideology. This is especially the case considering that, according to a survey done by Chapman University, 57% of the American public believes Atlantis is real.
That is shockingly high, Liv.
Oh, yeah. Like, no, that's...
More than one in two Americans is like, yep, Atlantis, real.
I mean, yeah, of course people believe in QAnon. They believe Atlantis? Come on.
I'm pretty cynical, but even then, I assumed it'd be less than 40%.
Thankfully, the American public doesn't agree entirely with Heinrich Himmler's account of Atlantis, at the time of writing this at least. Regardless, how did this ancient Greek utopian story, that most of the ancients didn't even take seriously, become so influential, both in the American consciousness as well as within the ideology of prominent Nazi officials like Heinrich Himmler? Our story begins thousands of years ago with Plato. Plato wished to create a parable that could demonstrate the power of the political system he put forward in the Republic. In his dialogue Timaeus, he constructs the idea of a powerful utopia located somewhere far off in the Atlantic, beyond the reach of any puny ancient Greek ship. This island nation was so strong that it was able to subjugate all the known worlds hundreds of years before Plato was writing. That is, except for the Athenian Republic, which, according to Plato, had lived by his standards for what makes a republic good, and subsequently managed to ward off conquest. This is essentially the equivalent of Plato drawing his republic as the Chad Wojak and everyone else's soy. But more importantly, the mythical land described by Plato that only his special Chad republic could fight against was known as Atlantis. It's important to stress that the story of Atlantis was quite literally made up by Plato. It is unlike other ancient Greek utopia mythologies that were also made up, such as Hyperborea or the Elysian Plain, that were more widely believed in ancient times and a product of a larger social community building a mythology to help explain their history. Atlantis really was just one guy writing a fake story, and Plato figuratively admits this. He plays around quite a bit with mythology in some of his works, and further explicates in The Republic that sometimes a well-constructed noble lie is necessary to provide the commoners a truth they cannot come to understand. So Plato argues that mythology could not hope to meaningfully convey truths about the past, but if these mythologies help develop, for instance, social cohesion, then they would be acceptable to be spread around. As a result, ironically, Plato has accidentally duped millions of people in the future with one of his noble lies, except it is entirely detached from the original purpose of this lie, which was to promote his social system.
Interesting. So this is kind of like a bit like if there are millions of people who believe that there is a literal cave in which people were imprisoned and shown only shadows of figures.
Yeah. Wait, they're what?
They're playing Joss Whedon movies on the wall, and that's why you never look away and leave the adrenochrome cave.
That's all the ancient history that you will get in today's episode. This is because Atlantis...
Thanks, Liv. Thanks.
This is firstly because ancient history is boring, but secondly because Atlantis, as we understand it, as well as how the Nazis did, is almost entirely a modern construction and takes very little from the original milieu which Plato was writing in. Now we have to travel thousands of years into the future, to 1831. Ignatius L. Donnelly was an American politician and writer who single-handedly began the modern craze around the search for Atlantis. In his book, Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, he asserted that Plato's story was, in fact, not a fabrication, but actually a true story documenting the original homeland of all human civilization. Rome, ancient Greece, Mesopotamia, Egypt, etc., all owe their heritage, according to Donnelly, to an incredibly advanced and ancient society located on a now sunken continent in the Atlantic. Donnelly is a part of a long string of dilettantes and pseudo-archaeologists that wish to go against the claims of Orthodox intelligentsia and create their own stories about, for instance, the origins of civilizations. This was a time in which archaeology and other specialized academic institutions were beginning to crystallize and alienate much of the public. American academic institutions, for instance, initially interacted with the public, specifically those in towns and cities that had universities and colleges. But in the 19th century, there was a closing off of this participation by the general population in academic discourses. Donnelly is one of many who existed within the reaction to this trend as it was taking shape in American life, turning away from the standards of academic archaeologists and towards his own crank mythologies. The antediluvian world and the general strategy of a pseudo-archaeology not beholden to the academic standards of actual archaeologists would later influence a multitude of figures, including the theosophists like Helena Blavatsky, and later even Heinrich Himmler, who would be convinced that Donnelly's account of the origin of the Aryan race and of human civilization was at least somewhat correct, and could be proven by his own pseudo-archaeological digs. To be clear, Donnelly himself was not a proto-Nazi. His political career was quite progressive, and he was a champion of women's suffrage, for instance. But his pseudo-intellectual ramblings, however interesting they were, would most certainly come to influence the belief systems of some of the worst men in history. In an impressive display of human pattern recognition skills, Donnelly collected numerous different, ostensibly disconnected origin mythologies and stories from various ancient societies across the world, such as Norse, Egyptian, Mesopotamian, Semitic, Incan, and argued they all have an important common thread, the existence of flood-based origin myths. This common thread is the product of all these civilizations owing their origin to the previously existing, now underwater, society of Atlantis. Donnelly placed the origin of these flood mythologies in the fact that these civilizations were started by Atlanteans, who either conquered or settled in these various areas, and had to flee away from Atlantis after it supposedly sunk into the ocean in around 12,000 BC. It could not possibly be the case, of course, that these different flood mythologies simply came from the fact that civilizations are often founded and thrive near large bodies of water, like rivers, and therefore flooding was a real and active threat to these people, who would subsequently conceptualize their origin through a wiping away of whatever existed before them. No, it must have been that they all genuinely did experience the same traumatic flooding events, one described by Plato in his dialogue about the once great civilization of Atlantis.
This is fascinating because it just shows that there's this huge kind of tapestry of history, including, yeah, cranks, people trolling, and essentially Plato managed to, by mistake, do an Operation Mindfuck here.
Yeah. Yeah, baking has always existed. People love to bake.
Yeah, you can look back and it's like, it was written hundreds of years ago. I mean, what more proof do you need that this is a description of reality?
What are, astrological constellations other than baking the stars? Mm.
Those at least are cool as fuck. They sound cooler than reading freaking Plato or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially because they bring with them a glossary of personalities that, every single human being fits into.
Yeah, Plato, give me a half horse, half man who fucking slings a mean bow.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's like, I mentioned this before about like Hyperborea and stuff. Like those mythologies are enshrined through like poets, for instance, who were like cool and interesting and all the people liked them. And no one liked the philosophers, as we can see what happened with Socrates, because they were lame and boring.
It's going to be so awesome when people like 1,000 years from now were like, at the time, they had a farm full of animals that could speak. And on this animal farm, a lot of things happened in history.
According to Donnelly, one of the primary groups that owes its history to the Atlanteans are the Aryans. Now, it's important to contextualize the use of this word in the 19th century. The Aryan peoples were a perceived group thought up by philologist William Jones half a century before Donnelly. William Jones found striking similarities between a multitude of different language groups, like Germanic, Romance, Greek, Persian, and Northern Indian, that he argued could only have possibly meant that these different languages shared a common ancestor language. Jones noted how the term Arya in Greek and Latin seemed to denote a noble person or noble act, while in Sanskrit, a northern Indian language that the Vedic religious texts were written in, the term denoted both a member of the aristocracy as well as simply someone who spoke Sanskrit. He decided that these similarities meant that an Aryan people who originated somewhere in Europe and had light skin, invaded northern India and Iran, setting up a racial caste-based system that produced the Vedas and led northern India to its cultural and civilizational peak.
I mean, this is literally saying, well, they couldn't have done it on their own, like all that great discovery and amazing culture. They must have been dominated and subjugated by whites who were better at it than
them. This is sort of the origin of like ancient alien stuff. Like it must have been aliens that made the civilization because it wasn't white people.
It must have been white people. They were the original aliens. This technology can only be white.
Now, Jones happened to be right about the similarities between these languages. And the Indo-European language group is the largest language group in the world, encompassing Romance, Germanic, Slavic, Baltic, Iranian, Hindi, and other languages. And linguists have constructed a Proto-Indo-European that is the mother tongue of all of them. Yet, of course, his theory of an Aryan invasion into India and Pakistan is absurd. There is no quote-unquote Aryan race that conquered that region. And genealogical evidence, for instance, demonstrates this. Jones makes this assumption to justify his own political context, in which Britain was actively invading and colonizing the Indian subcontinent. As evidence against Jones, there's even explicit textual evidence within the Vedas of local groups assimilating into Vedic cultural practices, who were then subsequently referred to as Arya. So there's clearly no quote-unquote Aryan race. It's important to note that Jones was not a fringe, crank academic, and his findings, alongside his absurd and now flatly discredited Aryan invasion thesis, was also widely accepted by European academics of his time. It's not a surprise, then, that most of these theories are also accepted by a crank writer 50 years later, such as Donnelly. Donnelly imagined the Aryans to be descendants of Japheth, or one of Noah's sons in the Abrahamic flood mythology. Some of these Aryans managed to escape Atlantis and initially settled around modern-day Armenia, which is one of the more prominent theories for where the Indo-European peoples actually originated. According to Donnelly, they were initially a very peaceful and advanced society, as they inherited their civilization from Atlantis. Donnelly writes of the Aryans in their initial homeland that
a still further evidence of the civilization of this ancient race is found in the fact that, before the dispersion from their original home, the Aryans had reached such a degree of development that they possessed a regularly organized religion. They worshipped God, they believed in an evil spirit, they believed in a heaven for the just. All this presupposes temples, priests, sacrifices, and an orderly state of society.
This is all based on nothing, to be clear. He just made it up.
That is an incredibly stupid deduction. They believed in God and an evil spirit. They were clearly incredibly civilized.
Yeah, and we don't fully know where the Indo-European homeland is anyways, so there's no possible frame of reference to make that assertion. But eventually, after thousands of years, their supposed peaceful nature changed as they strayed further away from the ancient Atlantean ideal. They then, as we can see in the quote, dispersed from the homeland and conquered many different regions in a similar way that Jones describes. It's important to note, again, that Donnelly's views of Atlantis and the Aryans are far away from the racism of Jones and later Himmler, even if he does trade in much of their language. But there were most certainly other crackpot intellectuals who appropriated Jones' works who did have explicitly racist intentions. Arthur de Gobineau is perhaps the most important 19th century theorist to bridge the gap between Jones's account of Aryans into Heinrich Himmler's. He's arguably the first to say that the Aryans are a quote-unquote master race, who are stronger than all others in virtue of their biology. In An Essay on the Inequality of the Human Races, he argues that the Germanic peoples are the most pure-blooded Aryans. He's the first one to do so. To be clear, this nationalistic Frenchman is so racist, he's willing to argue that it is the Germans who are the master race.
Well, yeah. That's interesting. But it reminds me a little bit of the way that a lot of white nationalists argue that Asians have the highest IQs, where they say, like, hey, I can't be a white nationalist if I'm praising a different race, huh?
Right.
One may be surprised to see Gobineau say this, of course, given the fact he's French, but his Germanophilia comes, likely, primarily from his disdain for the French Third Republic and his legitimist monarchist political sympathies. So it was the cucked liberals that made France not as good.
Nice.
Shadowing Jones's view, Gobineau argues that the 10 greatest civilizations of the world were in some way started by the Aryans, and that the distinctly, quote-unquote, non-Aryan civilizations were once conquered and given civilization by these Aryans. This even vaguely mirrors Donnelly to a certain respect, except that instead of the Atlanteans being responsible for all civilization, it is instead the Aryans. Gobineau also imagined these ancient Aryans, who were responsible for founding Greece, Rome, Persia, and others, as a blonde race of tall, beautiful, fair-skinned people. One is able to understand the extent to which an ethno-religious group can build and maintain an advanced civilization, for Gobineau, based upon how much Aryan blood is in their DNA. Remember, again, that the notion of an Indo-European DNA set is sort of ridiculous. I do not wish to compare Gobineau and Himmler to Donnelly directly, of course, but just to show that even in those supposedly anti-racist appropriations of the notion of an Aryan people, they're built on a vaguely similar notion of migration and civilizational construction. It is not the material and political realities of a people that determine their quote-unquote development or advancement, but the type of culture, or potentially genetic code, that these peoples have inherited.
Blavatsky and the Theosophists.
To understand how Himmler and other members of the Nazi Party engaged with the notions of Aryanism and Atlantis, we have to take a detour through Theosophy and the life of Helena Blavatsky, who was a significant, controversial, and prolific occultist born in 1831, who was a seminal figure in the Theosophical movement and later, more broadly, in Western esoteric spiritualism. If one is into or researches New Age spiritualism and a lot of the conspiracy theories related to it, you will recognize quite a bit in Blavatsky. She is the sort of center of a lot of this. She also owes quite a bit of her understanding of the world to Donnelly, and falls into many of the same problems that he does. While she was explicitly anti-colonial, especially in relation to the British Raj, much of her work existed within a milieu of esoteric spiritualism, pondering about Atlantis and the Aryan race that would later be appropriated by the Nazis. After getting married to Nikifor Blavatsky at age 17, which she would explain was a product of her attraction to Nikifor's supposed love of magic, ladies, get you a man who can do some magic spells.
This is like, yeah, Matt Gaetz with a hat and a rabbit.
Helena would then escape this marriage by traveling the world. There is essentially no reliable account of her life during this period, so it's very likely much of the story she gives is bullshit. There is some tangential evidence she was actually a circus performer during this period of her life, but it's shoddy at best, and her followers will deny this fact. As she traveled the world, Blavatsky allegedly repeatedly encountered a group known as the Masters of Ancient Wisdom. She argued that through her contact with these masters, they revealed that there is a hidden religion that maintains a supposed ancient wisdom that is present all across the world and functions as an occult-like secret society. This society maintains ancient truths about magic, astral projection, and the true origins of the human race. Her own spiritual doctrines were meant to be a revival of this supposed secret society in the West. She would found the Theosophical Society in 1875 to spread the supposed teaching of the Hidden Masters, and according to Theosophists, it is actually these secret masters who founded the movement, egging Blavatsky on to popularize their teachings. There was also no empirical evidence that any of these people existed, of course.
Yeah, this seems like channeling.
Yeah. Blavatsky's Theosophical Lodges were structured quite similarly to the Freemasons, and the Theosophical movement she would help found came in a time, the late 19th century, in which older Christian social institutions in Europe and America were being questioned. During this period of uncertainty, some turned to things such as Theosophy instead of more traditional sources to find spiritual guidance. Starting with Blavatsky's supposed encounter with a master in Istanbul, which was then Constantinople, he instructed her to travel across Asia Minor until she eventually reached Tibet, where she would study Buddhism and uncover the many hidden secrets of Oriental spiritual knowledge, staying near the Tashi Lhunpo Monastery. Again, this is most likely bullshit, and there's no verified evidence she even made it to Tibet during this period of her life. She's a great poster, though. It's sort of like Hugh in the sense that there are these like magical secret beings who work in the shadows, who I'm connected to, who I can't prove that they exist, but they talk to me, and they have this really important knowledge that you should believe.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the politics are different, but you can understand how this is in conversation with fascism, like later on.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of the fact that she probably wasn't in Tibet in this period, the mythology she builds around her early stay in the Far East would substantially affect the burgeoning Theosophical movement that she would eventually help champion. According to her book, The Secret Doctrine, during her alleged stay in Tibet, she learned how to commune with some of these masters of ancient wisdom, who were supposedly clairvoyant, telepathic, could dematerialize on command, and could project their astral bodies outside of their corporeal ones. They taught her about the origins of the universe, or cosmogenesis. She explains that the cosmos, and everything contained within it, comes in and out of existence in intervals. Everything comes out of the primordial ooze, and eventually, one day, goes back into it. The active periods, such as the world as it exists now, are known as manvantaras. And the passive periods, when everything slithers back into the void, are known as pralayas. These two phrases are taken directly from Hindu cosmology, in which there is a similar cyclical understanding of the world. This is, of course, not a surprise, given her general attitude towards the East and its supposed collection of esoteric mystical knowledges that Western science cannot attain.
You know, this is interesting because it reminds me a lot of Alara, who spoke at the sort of the Q-pilled New Age conference we attended in Sedona. Because she was talking a lot about the cosmological evidence that the basically the universe is eternally recurring, that it expands and then it contracts back to its original primordial form, and it repeats this infinitely.
Yeah, that's all Blavatsky.
I will be right back. I just dumped my coffee all over my lap, making it look like I've had diarrhea out of my penis.
I saw that. That's... Yeah, the more you look into Blavatsky, the more you realize how incredibly influential she is, like, to Western, you know, Western appropriations and general misunderstandings of Buddhism, and, like, spiritualism, especially Sedona stuff. Following this cyclical understanding of time, during the end of each cycle, the human race essentially comes from a different set of what Blavatsky calls root races. These races develop after the end of every cycle, and humanity is the fifth root race. This may appear Darwinian, but following the period of different cosmological cycles, each root race exists for a few million years before evolving, not biologically through natural selection, but instead spiritually. According to her, the four previously existing root races only existed on now-forgotten continents. These different continents suggest that during each cycle, there is a massive seismic shift over the period of a few years that generates a new layout for the Earth's landmasses. The first root race is referred to as the etheric race. These beings were purely ethereal, meaning they did not have concrete bodies, but more so existed in the realm of vibes. They also reproduced asexually, by splitting off like amoeba. They only had a single sense in order to communicate, which was hearing. They did not have touch, for instance, as they were not physical beings. They were imagined to have lived on the mystical Mount Meru, a spiritually significant mountain range for Buddhist and Hindu cosmology, which is imagined to be the center of the universe. The second root race was the Hyperboreans. Hyperborea is similar to Atlantis insofar as it is an ancient Greek myth about a utopian society. Hyperborea, to the Greeks, was a sunlit realm in the far north, shielded from the boreal winds by the Riphean mountain range. These boreal winds were seen as the cause of all cold, and metaphorically all vicious acts as well. And therefore, these Hyperboreans existed in a sunlit, warm realm of virtue beyond them. Blavatsky takes this myth in an entirely different direction than the Greeks. She claims the Hyperborean peoples developed out of the ethereal race, gaining physical bodies and subsequently gaining the capacity to hear as well as touch. These beings also seemingly reproduced by budding.
You mean like you had little Hyperboreans that kind of sprouted out of the ground and then sort of grew into full-grown Hyperboreans?
Yeah, weird plant-like things, as far as I understand. They were also giants, which is a part of the Hyperborea myth, in which they're also giants that live long.
Poison Ivy and Batman is based on this.
That's true. It is Blavatsky builds. Blavatsky was quite fond of merging Oriental and Occidental myths, imagining that combining the supposedly unique truths contained within these two worlds would produce a more comprehensive understanding of cosmology. She's essentially attempting to draw out a truth about the origins of the world through all of these ancient peoples, imagining that modern scientific understandings of the past, which are generally deemed superior to all else, actually remove a certain crucial aspect of the truth. Of course, all of this is made up, to be clear.
is a recurring theme in our episodes. We have to remind people.
Yeah. This key drop? Not true, guys. Please do not. The third root race was of Lemuria, a proposed previously existing continent between Madagascar and South Asia, which would supposedly have explained the presence of lemur fossils exclusively in these two locations. Around Blavatsky's time, this theory was at its peak. It was similarly situated with Donnelly's archaeological research, insofar as it was done by a crank and was generally not well accepted within the academic field it was attempting to emulate. The Hyperboreans supposedly produced sweat drops that matured in the sun and produced eggs that the Lemurians popped out of.
Oh man, this is getting very florid. I like it.
Just regular stuff. Initially, the Lemurians were hermaphroditic and reproduced by themselves, but eventually split into two distinct sexes and reproduced as we do. which is actually from another Platonic mythology found within the Symposium, which, again, was not meant to be understood as true. This group was imagined to have abandoned Lemuria as it began to sink, and they would come to inhabit much of sub-Saharan Africa, modern-day Sri Lanka, and southern India. As one might have expected from 19th century Europeans, there was also a belief by prominent theosophists who followed Blavatsky's general analysis that sub-Saharan Africans and Dravidians were partial descendants of this third, less advanced root race. This is an excellent example of where theorists like Blavatsky and the work she inspires can help reinforce European colonial tools of domination, such as race science, the belief that the colonized are genetically inferior, etc., even if she herself is attempting to use an Orientalist position to empower the East.
Yeah, it's the same kind of contradictions we see in the New Age turn towards QAnon and the right.
All the initial New Age content they're being inspired by isn't explicitly racist, let's say,
no.
or fascist, but it's very easy to appropriate it in that way.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I opened my crown chakra and found out that the Jews are running the world.
And like, if you have that relationship to truth in the first place, what is stopping you from jumping there? If you benefit from that system, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It is important to note that Blavatsky's own account of race was not associated with this latter, more crudely Darwinian account of the evolution of root races. Blavatsky saw these races as developing spiritually, and physical characteristics were not less advanced in the earlier races. Additionally, the notion of different races among humans that signified different cultures and intellectual capacities is not how this concept is mobilized in Blavatsky. Her use of the word race was explicitly against the traditional Western understanding of different groups, with different identifiable phenotypical markers that signify their cultural and intellectual capacities. So it's like when someone says, I'm not racist, I'm a part of the one race, the human race. It's sort of that response. This leads us to the fourth root race, which is the Atlantean one. The Atlanteans had both psychic spiritual powers as well as an advanced civilization. They were referred to as almost human by Blavatsky. While Lemurians only had one eye in the middle of their head, Blavatsky claims, for instance, that Cyclops mythology was a memory of these ancient Lemurians, the Atlanteans developed two more eyes directly under this first one. This first eye, or what is generally referred to as a third eye, closed later on as Atlantis was sinking. Many of these Atlanteans were also giants, and were subsequently responsible for things such as Stonehenge. As a result of the Atlanteans being too powerful for their own good, they abused their capacities and doomed their continent, causing it to subsequently sink. This is all the psychic, spiritual powers they had. The sinking of Atlantis is the cause, according to Blavatsky, of all the flood origin stories we were talking about before, just as Donnelly had suggested. And Blavatsky is, of course, quite influenced by his work on Atlantis. It also, of course, differs greatly. But like other esoteric spiritualist texts, she is able to integrate certain elements of his bizarre pseudoscientific insight into her larger theory. The final existing root race, which is present during our current cycle, are the Aryans. These Aryans supposedly descended from the far north, from some of the surviving Atlanteans, after the first great flood wiped them out. This is also a notion that is directly influenced by Donnelly, who also perceives the Aryans as owing their heritage to the advanced civilizations that lived on Atlantis. It is also influenced by someone like Gobineau, who came up with the sort of Germanic supremacist account of Aryanism, insofar as it is a belief that the Aryans came from the far north. These Aryans are not similar to how someone like Gobineau describes them, though, insofar as all human beings are part of the Aryan race, and not a specific, supposedly superior, ethnocultural group. So we can't truly describe Blavatsky's appropriation of the idea of an Aryan race as racist in the same way we can easily ascribe this belief to someone like Gobineau. In fact, Blavatsky specifically rejected Darwinism altogether, and as a result, also social Darwinism. After the current root race is over, as it inevitably will come to an end, like the others, the land masses of the Earth, beginning with the British Isles for some reason, although I guess they deserve it, will supposedly sink, and Atlantis will reemerge in the Atlantic. Those humans, or Aryans in Blavatsky's terminology, who manage to escape will help evolve into the sixth root race. And because this root race has yet to happen, Blavatsky is only able to vaguely speculate about its nature, of course, as opposed to what she was doing before.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, so they can't speak to this new race with the same amount of rigor as she was talking about the ephemeral races.
The imaginary past is so much more crisp in my visions than the imaginary future.
She should have just predicted the future. She's like, also the masters can predict the future.
Don't pull back.
Yeah, we are encouraging Blavatsky to lie more. Please make up more stuff.
Yeah,
she's
yeah.
Being just annoying that... Do better world building, Blavatsky.
Yeah. This is some classic Blavatsky style fuck uppery. Also, Blavatsky just sounds like a racist cop.
Officer Blavatsky was found planting the baggie on the suspect.
This discussion of different races, and the most powerful currently existing race being the Aryans, unsurprisingly led to racist appropriations of Blavatsky's work, one of which I mentioned before, with a prominent theosophist using Blavatsky's analysis of Lemuria to argue that those with darker skin are less advanced.
Aryosophy and the birth of the Nazis.
The most influential, explicitly right-wing, esoteric movement influenced by Blavatsky and Theosophy was the Aryosophy movement, which quite literally means the study of Aryan knowledge. This movement essentially copied the secret society model of Blavatsky, and agreed with her that there was some form of ancient knowledge that these secret societies must unearth, except that they also believed in the Germanic Aryan racial ideology of Gobineau and those who came after him. The most notable Aryosophist of pre-war Austria was Guido von List, who helped construct a modern German paganist movement, hearkening back to a supposed Stone Age Aryan culture. In 1902, following a cataract operation that almost blinded him, List reportedly saw a vision of an alphabet made of Germanic runes. These runes supposedly opened his third eye, and became the key to reviving lost magical practices previously known to the Aryan race. This pagan movement, and the fetishization of Germanic runes alongside it, we will later see appropriated by the SS and other Nazis. In fact, the S symbol within the SS was quite literally taken from List's own construction of a Germanic rune alphabet.
Wow.
List glorified ancient Germanic tribes and their mystical knowledge while attempting to revive the supposed practices that gave these ancient Aryans their power. He also delved into prophecy writing and foretold of the Strong One from above, who would save the Aryan race from its supposed Jewish oppressors. It turns out there was a lot of people in Austria around this time that were fond of List's writings, and the Guido von List Society sprung up in Vienna. They modeled their club on List's idea that ancient Germanic cultures had an aristocratic class of magical priests known as Armanen. This secret society wished to revive the occult practices that gave these supposed ancient Germanic peoples their magical powers. Georg Lanz von Liebenfels then later broke off with the Guido von List Society and began his own secret Viennese club that borrowed many things from both the Theosophical Secret Societies of Blavatsky as well as the anti-Semitism and pan-German nationalism of List. This group would attempt to uncover the wisdom handed down by ancient Aryans and would explicitly call themselves Aryosophists. Among other things, Liebenfels believed that modern humans were a product of interbreeding between an ancient Aryan Gottenmenschen, or super race, and the quote-unquote lower races, who were sexually perverted subhumans that were, in incredibly unimaginative form, also much physically shorter than the Aryans. Mm-hmm. This is also sort of mirroring Jones's idea that the reason why the ancient northern Indian society became more decadent was because the ruling Aryan class interbred with the locals. Yeah, so we have essentially a transition from respectable European society to the Nazis, just like 100 years later, you know. Pre-war Germany continued to stew in the slime of occultist anti-Semitic secret societies, with other Aryosophists, like Hermann Pohl, making the Germanen Orden in 1912. 5 years later, in 1917, there marked a crucial schism within this group between a more insular occultist faction and an explicitly political group, who concerned themselves with affecting the social world outside of merely attaining ancient mystical occultist knowledge. The Munich branch of the Germanen Orden, which was stocked mainly with those in the occult wing, became led by adventurer Rudolf von Sebottendorf, who gave the society a facelift, renaming it the Thule Gesellschaft, or Thule Society. Under Sebottendorf's leadership, the Thule Society increased its membership by sevenfold. The Thule Society also created a political party through the new support it gained by post-war German far-right nationalists, known as the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, or the German Workers' Party, meant to target the more conservative elements of the German working and middle class. In 1919, a certain Austrian-born painter stepped into one of the political meetings of the DAP and got into a heated discussion. Those in the party were so fond of him, they invited him to join it. His name was Adolf Hitler.
Bam.
There it is.
A star is born.
The drop.
They were like, he draws amazing paintings on napkins when we hang out and drink beer.
Also, apparently, if you want to gain significant power, you get into political meetings and you start shit. Don't get along. Start shit.
They're like, I like this guy's vibes. Yeah. This is good. It's people starting shit. The German Workers' Party would be an incredibly crucial post-World War I breeding ground for Nazism to officially take shape. Hitler's newfound prominence within the party would make him come to the attention of influential and important members of the Thule Society, and, more generally, those in far-right politics within Munich. Many early members of the Nazi Party were subsequently drawn to him through his prominence there, those like Goering, Hess, Himmler, Hans Frank, Gottfried Feder, and others. He would also become acquainted through the Thule Society with Dietrich Eckart, who Hitler later described as the spiritual heart of the Nazi Party. Eckart was deeply involved in Ariosophic Bavarian circles and would greatly influence Hitler on the philosophical direction of the Nazi Party and even on his speechwriting skills. Hitler would eventually reform the DAP into the NSDAP, or of course the Nazi Party. So quote Greer's New Encyclopedia of the Occult.
While many other factors came together in Germany in the 20s and 30s to unleash Nazism on the world, the contribution of Ariosophy and certain other elements of the Western occult traditions was not a minor one.
While Hitler himself was not particularly interested in the occult, joining the German Workers' Party for purely political purposes, other important earlier members of the Nazi Party most certainly were. Heinrich Himmler, for instance, who was also a member of the Thule Society, took his esoteric obsession with the origins of the Aryan race with him into a position of power in Nazi Germany. Now, there was a brutal, influential member of government who explicitly believed the ancient Aryan race had magical powers and originated on the lost continent of Atlantis. Himmler would also help fund what can essentially be described as a think tank for pseudo-archaeological digs and other intellectual pursuits to prove his absurd beliefs about the Aryans originating in Atlantis. This institution was known as the Annenarbe, and it was a wing of the SS that was exclusively beholden to him.
This is interesting. It reminds me a lot about how evangelical Christians, they often go to Turkey in search of, like, Noah's Ark, because they really, really believe that it's landed there. And there have been many excavations there attempting to find wood from Noah's Ark.
Yeah, quite literally, exactly from the, like, Himmler playbook. The Annenarbe would fund various archaeological research groups and projects, all under the pretext of proving Aryan/Germanic supremacy across the world. An important aspect of essentially all these archaeological and anthropological investigations into the ancient Aryans and Atlantis is that they either proved absolutely nothing or entirely went against their main thesis. In fact, many of the Annenarbe's attempted archaeological digs and other quote-unquote research projects reportedly embarrassed many of the more conservative members of the Nazi Party, as Himmler's beliefs were antithetical with Christianity and seemingly celebrated the accomplishments of a Stone Age tribe that lived in huts. An example of one of the ridiculous expeditions the Annenarbe would fund happened after Hermann Wirths suggested that Atlantis was originally quite high up, and so the best place to find remnants of where the first Aryans fled to after it sunk was places like the Himalayas.
Oh, this is great. The Nazis should have really become obsessed with this kind of shit. Go get lost up there at the tallest, coldest peaks.
Yeah, more funding. More funding for this.
Try to reach the damn sky.
Wirth was also obsessed with finding Atlantis, and Himmler would integrate him into the Annenarbe after discovering his writings, as well as the House Atlantis, which he constructed purely for the research of the Aryan origins in Atlantis. Wirth believed that the ancient Aryans must have lived somewhere that was of higher altitude because of his notion of Weltislehre, or world ice theory. This was the belief that ice was the most basic substance of the universe, and therefore also of life. And so the evolutionary process that created the Aryan race must have happened around ice.
This also comes from a Batman movie, Mr. Freeze, played by Arnold Schwarzenegger, an Austrian.
Oh shit, it tracks. And now this theory is of course not based on any empirical evidence, but on a purported vision that Wirth had. Despite the fact that no scientist took this theory seriously, the Annenarbe was an institution with quite a large degree of state funding, and they hired Ernst Schaefer, a zoologist, to go on multiple expeditions to the Himalayas to help prove it. It's important to understand that despite the fact that all of the Annenarbe's exploits were bullshit, they had institutional power and money. And so if one looks at, for instance, German archaeology, many professional, serious archaeologists who worked in Germany from 1936 to 1945 worked in and produced Nazi propaganda, as to not do so would mean to be out of a job. In fact, Himmler getting into a powerful position within Nazi Germany was one of the best things that could have happened in terms of funding for ancient archaeology. Much of the actual discoveries that were funded by these digs are, like, quite important for the field, for instance. And so the rift between crank and professional archaeology that I talked about before, which began in the early 19th century, temporarily closed, with Nazi crackpot archaeologists forcing the professional ones to produce ideology for their hateful, racist, murderous regime. Think of if QAnon did a revolution and took power in America, and the only way historians could get a job is if they produced papers on how every Q job was real.
I can only hope this for Travis View. He will be put to the task.
You have to do like self-crit sessions about how Q is right.
Yeah, he's going to have a testimony for sure.
I'll be surrounded by, you know, Jordan Sather and praying medic and ghost Ezra and I'll pounding my chest, you know, exclaiming how wrong I was.
During the Nazi trip to Tibet, led by Ernst Schaefer, they supposedly found, among other things, conclusive evidence that the locals had Aryan genetics through the bunk science of phrenology and skull measuring. Schaefer and his team also collected and recorded various flora and fauna that were native to Tibet. Some of this flora was used for research to help attempt to boost the future agricultural yield of the proposed German colonies in Eastern Europe. These colonies were planned for after Germany conquered the region and killed all of its local inhabitants, settling Germans and formally annexing the territories directly into the Reich. So again, even for the supposedly innocent projects that were funded in German academia at the time, much of them connect back to Nazi ideology. Another theory for Atlantis, put forward by Edmund Kiss, a German archaeologist and eventual SS commander, was that Atlantis was actually in modern-day Peru and Bolivia. A Nazi expedition to Bolivia was never funded, but the notion that Tiwanaku, a pre-Columbian archaeological site in Bolivia, was evidence of Aryan activity in the region became quite popular in early Nazi high society. Party newspapers published supposed conclusive evidence that Tiwanaku was a Germanic city and that its architecture was emulated in early Nordic and Germanic archaeological sites in Europe. The Annenarbe would fund numerous other trips across the world to different archaeological sites, often handled by trained professional archaeologists, to attempt to prove Himmler's theories true. While much of the archaeological findings by Himmler were not particularly useful for this fact, they also had a very specific ideological goal that was attained regardless. Himmler would attempt to use his bunk archaeological findings to justify the Holocaust and the mass murder and political suppression of dissidents. He, for instance, used archaeological findings of preserved bodies in bogs in Northern Europe, dating back to the Iron Age, as evidence that ancient Aryans participated in the practice of murdering homosexuals. He got this idea explicitly from the Annenarbe and one of its archaeologists, and used the supposed evidence, which is entirely ludicrous, of course, as a justification for killing gay people in modern-day Germany. The Annenarbe also took part in the looting of Poland following its invasion by Germany in 1939. Some museums in Poland were looted of any supposedly Germanic artifacts to be put in SS members' own personal collections. They would help facilitate another similar operation in 1942 in Crimea. Much of Himmler's beliefs about the Aryans that he would help propagate in the Annenarbe, as well as elsewhere, were not merely archaeological in nature, and took a more spiritual turn, just as these beliefs had held a spiritual, paganistic theme in the Thule Society. An example of this can be seen in the previously mentioned House Atlantis, which was made by Wirth, that had initially adorned a large statue of the Norse god Odin being crucified. Another example of a reference to Germanic paganism, as I stated before, was the utilization of Germanic runes within even the SS symbol itself, which features two Sieg runes. This specific stylization of Germanic runes, known as Armenen runes, were actually made by Guido von List. He did base these runes on reconstructions of ones utilized in Proto-Germanic, but his specific runes are their own thing, only appropriated initially by the Nazis and now by neo-Nazis. This is one of the reasons why one should have at least a brief mental note of what these 18 runes created by List look like, if they're doing research for like far-right content, as the presence of these runes are often used to dog whistle that one is a Nazi. The Vevesselburg Castle is perhaps the most important key to understanding Himmler's attempt at creating some sort of neo-pagan cult only beholden to him within the SS. Himmler had decided he wanted an SS stronghold around where Arminius had lived, the Germanic king who defeated the Romans in Teutoburg Forest. And so the Vevesselburg Castle, which was owned by the state, was leased to the SS. He desired to turn it into an SS schoolhouse to teach about his bizarre Germanic religion. Himmler's attempt at expanding the castle to account for this education was a part of his goal of replacing the Christian German elite with a pagan elite only beholden to him and the institutions of the SS. Much of the design of the castle was based upon the previously mentioned Germanic runes, as well as some newer ones designed by Himmler and other members of the SS, such as the Sonnenrad or the Black Sun. Importantly, this attempt at creating a new pagan cult failed pretty miserably, but only really functioned in official customs that any higher-ranking member of the SS had to participate in, but didn't really believe sincerely. The primary legacy of Himmler's bizarre esoteric form of Nazism is, unsurprisingly, in the new rights and neo-Nazi movements, who often utilize some of his more lesser-known symbols to dog whistle to other Nazis. An example of this is found within far-right neo-pagan movements that often use Norse runes and imagery to signify an allegiance to the SS. The legacy of those who influence Himmler, such as Blavatsky and Donnelly, continues to spark fascination on the History Channel that often runs bizarre documentaries about some crank archaeologist who they treat as an expert in the field and their supposed attempts at uncovering the real, actually existing Atlantis. Much of this is relatively innocent, as it takes far more from Donnelly than it does of Himmler. And I would not be surprised if a new generation of neo-Nazis constructs their own weird new mythologies, not on the writings of a Donnelly, but instead on the content of the History Channel.
Wow.
Well, this may be concerned, like the greatest fascist dictator of the 21st century. His origin story will be one day as a boy who was watching Ancient Aliens when he was struck by the, you know.
Yeah, they're playing with fire.
Oh, man. You know, Tsoukalos would be first to go, too, under the new regime. Like, they don't have time for this, the fun, playful jackassery that he brings.
Yeah, no expeditions.
I do love how much money they wasted. This reminds me of Lysenkoism, where the state just backs, yeah, like, a totally fucking esoteric belief system and makes it systemic, so it just wastes so much money. Yeah, this makes, like, the war trains in the mountain seem almost like a good spending. Thanks for listening to another premium episode of the QAnon Anonymous podcast. Your support helps us stay advertising free and editorially independent. You can also go check out Liv Agar's podcast by typing in Liv Agar anywhere where podcasts are distributed.
I also just had a larger two-part that's sort of about this and goes more into the ancient Greek mythology stuff. So if anyone wants to listen to two more hours of this, go to that.
If this rabbit hole was just a little too short for you, go go get that stuff. But also, you'll be doing more readings of Marx's Capital, right?
Yes, that as well, yeah.
For everything else, we have a website. Go check it out at QAnonAnonymous.com.
Listener, until next week, may the deep dish bless you and keep you.
It's not a conspiracy. Yeah, it's fact.
And now, today's auto-cue.
I'd like to begin by offering my thanks to the organizers of this wonderful gathering, and especially for their giving me the honor of participation. Secondly, I'd like to extend my best wishes to Theosophists all over the world. Thank you so much for your hard work in spiritual practice, spiritual endeavor, and in the universal attempt to carry light and goodness deeper into this world of ours. For my paper, we've titled it Blavatsky, The Secret Doctrine, Kalachakra, and Shambhala.